Good evening. I'd like for us to pick up again tonight in the book of Isaiah. And Dr. Jeff, I think last week covered two chapters in Acts. Well, tonight we're going to try to make it through nine. But you'll understand in a minute how we're going to do that. It's not going to be verse by verse. We're going to be looking primarily at the subject matter from chapters 14 through 23. And just by way of review, I'm not going to do a lot of review. It's been a while since we've looked at this, and it stretches back to last year, early in the year. But we're looking at six themes in the book of Isaiah. The first, God's favor to Israel. The second, Israel's rebellion. The third has to do with God's judgment. And it's broken into two pieces. We saw God's judgment of the nation of Israel. And then last time, we looked at God's judgment of the entity called Babylon. And we saw how it was both a nation, an empire, but then it spans the scripture to represent a overall rebellion against God's authority. Starting with the Tower of Babel, going all the way through the book of Revelation in various manifestations. Tonight, we're going to continue looking at God's judgment of the enemies of God's people. And then in the future, at some point, we'll look at Israel's promised future. We'll look at the preservation of the righteous. And we'll look at the variety of messianic prophecies that are contained within the book of Isaiah. So as we look tonight at the nations that kind of surround Israel, and in the book of Isaiah we find in this passage, these nine chapters, it's not 100% dedicated to God declaring judgment on these nations, but about 90% of it is dedicated to that. And we're going to do a 30,000 foot flyover. So we're not going to go through and look at a lot in detail, but rather we're going to look at the historical relationship between these nations and the nation of Israel and what that represents, I think, in terms of the enemy's tactics of attacking God's people. And I think we can see a pretty wide array of the tactics that the enemy uses to attack God's people even today. So let's look just for a minute, if I can get this thing to work. All right. It's coming. Hopefully. Maybe. Okay. So this is a map of the nation of Israel, pretty much during the time that we're looking at. And you'll notice several different countries around Israel that we're going to see or find in the book of Isaiah mentioned and singled out for judgment. We're going to see Philistia, which is over on the, that would be the west coast, right at the Mediterranean Sea. We're going to see Moab, which is in this area to the east of Israel. Now, Ammon is not specifically singled out in the book of Isaiah, and I can't tell you why, but I do know in the scripture that Moab and Ammon tend to be linked together very frequently in their relation to Israel and in God's view of what He's going to do there. So I'm going to take that the discussion about Moab is also somewhat inclusive to Ammon. We then see God's judgment declared on, let's see if I can pull this down, on Damascus. And Damascus, of course, is the capital city of the country at that time of either called Aram or Syria. So Damascus really represents Syria. So you can see already that we're making a pretty good perimeter around Israel with regard to the nations that are being addressed in the book of Isaiah. Now, up to the left, another city is singled out, and that's the city of Tyre. And that is representative to a degree of the Phoenician nation. But Tyre was such a dominant entity in and of itself that it deserves really its own place in this judgment declaration. And then finally, down south, we'll find mention of Egypt. And in fact, there's also mention of, in the King James Version, Ethiopia, but a lot of translators feel like that's a mislabel, that it refers in the Hebrew to Cush, which is a kind of a neighboring, partnering country with Egypt. So again, it really encompasses the enemy to the south. Now, the one that's not mentioned, I take that back. Edom is mentioned once under the name of Dumah. And it's not really mentioned in a declaration of judgment. And the only thing that I can come away with on that is, you know, God basically told Israel, you leave the Edomites alone. You don't mess with them. They were Ishmael's descendants and Esau's descendants. And God had promised them the land that they were in. So they were in a promised land, in essence, the same as Israel was in a promised land. And that's the only reason I can think of that they aren't singled out really for judgment in this particular case. So that's what we're going to be looking at. And we're going to see that each of these countries, I think, can represent. I'm not saying this is the way to interpret it, but they can represent different tactics that the enemy uses to attack God's people. So that's all we're going to use that for. Can you turn it off? You want me to turn it off? Well, maybe I can. There we go. Now, just a note about the enemy before we go into that, and I think it's important for us to keep in mind, there's really only one real enemy of God's people, and that's Satan. And he manifests himself all through the Scriptures in different ways. And I'm reminded of what we find in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12, where we're told that our enemy is a spiritual enemy. We're told there, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. Now, in this case, many different manifestations of flesh and blood, but that wasn't the real enemy. We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. And as we consider these different nations that set themselves at enmity with God's people, I think we'll see tactics that he also uses today. So hopefully we can look at these and we can identify the tactics and we can then see them when they're happening and recognize this is the enemy and then look at how to deal with it. So the first one, I need to get my Bible, is in chapter 14, towards the latter part of the chapter. And the first one that is actually highlighted after Babylon is highlighted is Philistia. Now also in the King James, I think it calls it Palestinia. But the most interpreters associate it with Philistia. So that's what we're going with tonight. So down in verse 28, we're just going to read about five verses here. And it starts off, it says, in the year that King Ahaz died, came this oracle. Now Ahaz was one of the kings of Judah. And the Davidic kingdom, the kingdom of David and Solomon and the descendants had largely kept Philistia under control. You know the story of David, the frequent battles. You know in Saul's time how the Philistines were constantly coming in. We heard Sunday how David even aligned himself with the Philistines, much to his chagrin. And so we see them as a constant enemy, but during David's rule, and Solomon's rule, and even the subsequent rules, when the kings were following after God, the Philistines were largely kept at bay. And that's an important point to remember. So here, what we see is King Ahaz had died, He had had some success against Philistia, and so what would you expect the enemy to do? All right, we're ready to go. We're going to go get them now. And through Isaiah, God is warning them, don't count your chickens before they hatch. It says, rejoice not, O Philistia, all of you, that the rod that struck you is broken. For from the serpent's root will come forth an adder, and its fruit will be a flying, fiery serpent. And the firstborn of the poor will graze, and the needy lie down in safety. But I will kill your root with famine, and your remnant it will slay. Wail, O gate, cry out, O city. Melt in fear, O Philistia, all of you. For smoke comes out of the north, and there is no straggler in its ranks. What will one answer the messengers of the nation? The Lord has founded Zion, and in her the afflicted of his people find refuge. So here we find this declaration of judgment. It's a pretty general declaration. Doesn't highlight a lot of individual sins or anything like that, but you can tell from here, Philistia is facing problems, and they're going to be brought about by God. Now, let's think about their history. You go back to Abraham's day. And in Abraham's day, he sojourned in the land of a king called Abimelech. And Abimelech was really the king of what? Philistia. Okay? And one of the very first events that's recorded associated with Philistia, the servants of the king violently took away a well that Abraham had dug. So right off the bat, we see this violent conflict. There is never, to my knowledge, an attempt by Philistia to become friendly with Israel. From that moment forward, their approach was always to destroy. And that's what characterizes this particular nation. A similar conflict was found in Isaac's day in Genesis chapter 26. In Exodus 13, I always thought this was a really neat object lesson. When God was bringing the children of Israel out of Egypt, bringing them to the promised land, can anybody tell me what he told them he was not going to do in relation to the Philistines? Just in general terms. He said, I'm not going to lead you that way because you as a young nation might see war and turn back. So once again, we see this violent intent of Philistia. And God protected the infant nation from coming into that kind of violent conflict because right off the bat, he knew they'll turn around and run straight back to Egypt. And that's not what he wanted for them. So he protected them by taking them out of the way. Again, we've referred to the times of the judges. We know Samson's history. And the constant battles with the Philistines, what did they want to do? They wanted to kill him. That's what they were constantly trying to do, to trick him and kill him. And then, of course, in Saul's reign, we see it again. And we find mention, I believe it was during Saul's reign, where all the weapons of war except two were in Philistia because they were experts in metalwork. So they had built a military weaponry that many of the nations around them didn't have. So again, we see this expressed intent. They were bent on destroying God's people. And I'm reminded of what we find in 1 Peter 5:8 that speaks of our adversary, who as a roaring lion walks about seeking whom he may devour. And this is the important point. We're going to look at some other tactics. They seem less dangerous than somebody just flat out ready to kill you. But that's always his intent. He disguises it in different ways. But what does it say in John chapter 8, I believe? That he's a murderer. That's what he wants to do. From the time he was in the garden, and he tried to convince Adam and Eve to disobey God, he knew that God had said it would bring death. His intent all along was to destroy them. And so with Philistia, we see this most aggressive characterization of our enemy to destroy. But then we move to Moab and Ammon, and that's in chapters 15 and 16. And we're going to read just a few verses out of that. So in chapter 15, start with verse 1. And it says, an oracle And I'm reading in ESV. I think it, King James says a burden. An oracle concerning Moab, because Ar of Moab, one of the main cities, is laid waste in a night. Moab is undone, because Ker of Moab is laid waste in a night. Moab is undone. So right off the bat, God is declaring coming judgment on the nation of Moab. Now turn over to chapter 16, and let's pick up at verse 6. There it says, "We have heard of the pride of Moab, how proud he is, of his arrogance, his pride, and his insolence. In his idle boasting, he is not right." So we see there a specific condemnation, and then drop down to verses 12 through 14. "And when Moab presents himself, when he wearies himself on the high place, when he comes to his sanctuary to pray, he will not prevail. This is the word that the Lord spoke concerning Moab in the past, but now the Lord has spoken, saying, in 3 years, like the years of a hired worker, the glory of Moab will be brought into contempt in spite of all his great multitude, and those who remain will be very few and feeble." So we see this very clear declaration of judgment on Moab, and I think it probably relates to Ammon as well. Who were Moab and Ammon? Okay, Lot's incestuous children. And so right off the bat, they had a very fleshly, carnal beginning. And we see their characteristic carrying forward in their nation. It was an idolatrous nation. It was an immoral nation. And when God brought Israel out of Egypt, he brought them around that way, and they were at the entry point. Now, they destroyed the Amorites, King Sihon. They destroyed them. And we find that the Amorites had previously defeated Moab. So what do you think Moab's attitude was at that point? They were pretty worried, because Israel had now destroyed an enemy that had conquered them. And so Israel came to their borders, and they simply said, "Would you please let us pass through? We don't want to fight with you. We're not here to take your land. Just let us pass through. We won't take anything. If we do, we'll pay you for it." And Moab said, "No way. We're not letting you through." And Ammon did the same thing. And you remember the king was King Balak. And again, he was in fear because of the power he had heard accompanying Israel. And so he came up with a different solution. He said, "I got a great plan. We're going to call this sorcerer guy. And his name was Balaam. And we're going to get him to come, and he's going to pronounce a curse on these people." And so you know the story. Balaam came. He was a hired prophet. He wasn't really a prophet of God. He was a sorcerer. And yet God communicated with him, and that's what we heard Sunday too. He also communicated to his donkey, because Balaam was so stubborn. And so Balaam attempted, I think it was three times, to pronounce a curse on God's people. And every time God turned it around, and he pronounced a blessing. And in one of those, at least one of them, he ended up cursing the Moabites. And he said they were going to be destroyed. So that would seem to be the end of the story. And yet, Balaam was a pretty wily kind of guy. And we find later, I'm going to lose my place here if I'm not careful. We find later in Numbers chapter 22 that Balaam actually gave advice to the enemy. And he said, "Get your women to mix with them and to entice them to intermarry." And that's what happened. And God brought judgment on Israel because of the intermarrying with the Moabites, and it also calls them the Midianites. And so that's what happened. And so their tactic was not to fight. It was not to destroy. It was to entice them to enter in to unequal, defiling relationships. Let's read Numbers chapter 25, just to touch on this. Verses 1 through 3. Numbers 25, 1 through 3. And it says there, "While Israel lived in Shittim, The people began to whore with the daughters of Moab. These invited the people to sacrifice to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel yoked himself to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. And now turn over to chapter 31. Verse 16. And this is where we see it attributed back to Balaam. It says, "Behold, these on Balaam's advice caused the people of Israel to act treacherously against the Lord in the incident of Peor, and so the plague came upon among the congregation of the Lord." So the tactic was to entice them to enter into prohibited relationships. And I think that's what Paul warns us of in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14, where he says, "Be not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness?" Now, I think it can relate to marriage, even dating. I think it can relate to business partnerships and other times, other situations where we yoke ourselves. A yoke was a device that was put around two animals to bind them together in the same work. So if you had two oxen that you were using to pull your plow, you had a yoke that tied them together so that they would not go in this direction and break your plow apart. Okay? They would go in the same direction. Well, imagine two people yoked together that don't believe the same. In a marriage, it's not going to be pretty. And young people, I would strongly urge you, there is no reason to date an unbeliever. None, period, unless you're an unbeliever. If you're an unbeliever, you go for it. But if you're a believer, there is no reason to date an unbeliever, because it could lead to marriage. And you could end up with a tumultuous relationship where you're not bound together. You can even have two believers, in my opinion, unequally yoked together. One that has a strong desire to serve the Lord, the other one that's more carnal. That's not happy either. Okay? Or a business partnership. You, for convenience or because somebody's so smart or whatever, enter into a partnership and now you're stuck. And you can work out ahead of time ways to get out, but you have to make decisions considering the decisions your partner will make. And it can make a mess. And there are other situations like that too. So that is a tactic of Satan. And how many of us have seen promising, godly young people that for some reason decided they were going to marry an unbeliever? And I have to think it's because they got tired of waiting for the Lord to bring the right person along. Or they were afraid that the Lord wasn't going to meet that need. But He will. So this is another tactic of the enemy, bringing us into unequal yokes. Then that brings us to the third, and that is listed as Damascus, again, the city, but really relates to Syria. And that's going to be in Isaiah chapter 17. And so we're going to read the first three verses of that just to get the connection. "An oracle concerning Damascus. Behold, Damascus will cease to be a city and will become a heap of ruins. The cities of Aroer are deserted. They will be for flocks which lie down, and none will make them afraid. The fortress will disappear from Ephraim, the kingdom from Damascus, and the remnant of Syria will be like the glory of the children of Israel, declares the Lord of hosts." Now, what was going on with Syria? At this time, Syria and the northern tribes, which were called Ephraim at times, had joined together in a military and political alliance. The northern tribes were still God's people. We remember in Elijah's day when he was so distraught, he said, "I'm the only one left." And God said, "No, I still have 7,000 people that haven't bowed the knee to Baal." It was a small remnant, but it was a remnant of God's people in the northern tribes. And so here we find that the northern tribes had joined forces with an enemy to bolster their military power. And they then came against the southern tribe to try to overtake it. The tactic that I believe we find here is that sometimes people that are desiring to do the work of God join forces with the enemy, thinking that it's going to make the work of God go forward. Now, there's an example of this in Ezra, where Zerubbabel in the early part of the book of Ezra had gone to rebuild the temple, and they had started the work. And some of the locals, the enemy that didn't want to see it going, they came along and they said, "Let us join with you in the work." Now, Zerubbabel was pretty wise, and he said, "You have no part in this work. None." Well, now, why did they want to join in the work? Did they want to see the temple rebuilt? No, they wanted to hinder it. They wanted to do what they could to slow it down, to distract them, to do. And so often that can happen in the work of God. Now, it's easy for us, I think, to connect the work of God being in a work like an assembly or a business, for instance. I work with businesses, and one of the things we emphasize is your business can be a ministry for Christ if you focus on it. I have one business that I work with, and over the past 5 years, they've seen almost 200 people come to Christ. Now, you find churches that do that. There aren't a whole lot. They are intentional about the relationships that they have and using those relationships to present Christ. So that's what's possible. I've got another member who has that desire, but recently he made a couple of hires. Because he wants to see his business bigger, because if it's bigger, what? You have more relationships. You have more opportunities. This company that has seen almost 200 people come to Christ, they have 2,000 employees. Okay? So they have a much bigger mission field. Well, this guy, in his heart, I know he wants to see that happen, but he's brought on a couple guys that are supposedly smart people, but they're not believers. And I already see the disjointed effort that's going on there. They don't care about ministry. They'll give lip service to it in the interview process when you're hiring them. And so what has happened? I think the world has come alongside saying, "Let us be part of this work." And it's not working. Now, what about our personal lives? Again, I think there are different ways where this particular tactic can hit us and affect us. It could be a young person with a heart and even a calling for a certain type of ministry effort, and they get sidetracked by a different career because they think, well, if I have a career and make money, then I'll be able to do these things. And that's not necessarily bad. Like I've already given you examples, work can be a wonderful ministry. We've got a false dichotomy that says ministry is this stuff in the nonprofit world, and work is work. That's not true. It doesn't have to be true. But we've seen people that have gone that direction. What about a young mom desiring to raise godly kids but getting distracted by excessive busyness? As she carries her kid to every activity, she works hard to keep the house clean, to fix the meals, etc., etc., and she ends up with famine in her soul. Distracted by things that just aren't what she needs to be focused on. So we can see it happening in personal lives as well. And keep in mind, Ephesians 2:10 tells us that our personal life is the work of God. He's created us unto good works, which He previously determined that we should be involved with. He's already got it laid out for you. But you can get distracted by thinking that there are better ways to get there rather than depending on Him in faith. Now that brings us to the fourth enemy. And that's going to be over in chapter 23. We're actually going to jump over Egypt for a minute, and there's a reason for that. And we're going to jump over to chapter 23, where we find this nation called, or this city called Tyre identified. And we're going to read verse 1 and then verses 6 through 11. The oracle concerning Tyre, wail, O ships of Tarshish, for Tyre is laid waste, without house or harbor. From the land of Cyprus it is revealed to them. And down to verse 6. Cross over to Tarshish, wail, O inhabitants of the coast. Is this your exultant city, whose origin is from days of old, whose feet carried her to settle far away? Who has purposed this against Tyre? The bestower of crowns, whose merchants were princes, whose traders were the honored of the earth. The Lord of hosts has purposed it, to defile the pompous pride of all glory, to dishonor all the honored of the earth. Cross over your land like the Nile, O daughter of Tarshish. There is no restraint anymore. He has stretched out his hand over the sea. He has shaken the kingdoms. The Lord has given command concerning Canaan to destroy its strongholds. So God declares judgment on this city of Tyre. Now, what was Tyre? It was a seaport. It was a very strategic seaport. And much of the economic trade of that region of the world flowed through Tyre. And it made them incredibly wealthy. Now, there's another little tidbit that we find over in Amos chapter 1, verse 9. And I'm not going to turn there for the sake of time, but if you look at Amos, you find judgment declared against these same entities. And here's what Tyre was said to be guilty of. They had taken captive slaves from the nation of Israel and sold them. So here's what I think that's telling us. Tyre never militarily went against Israel that I know of. In fact, David had a close alliance with Tyre, bringing in materials to build various parts of the city of David and the temple, etc., etc. And there was a close relationship between David and the king of Tyre. And yet that did not stop the Tyrians, the whatever they were, the citizens of Tyre, from making a market in Jewish slaves. Why? Greed. We can make a buck. It doesn't matter how we do it. It doesn't matter what the situation is. We can make a buck. And God is bringing judgment on Tyre because of their absolute failure to discern their economic activity. And again, I'm reminded that we cannot serve God and money. He doesn't say it's hard to do. He says you can't do it. You can't serve God and money. And Paul tells us in 1 Timothy 6, verses 9 through 10, those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Now, money in and of itself is not sinful. It's not anything. It's just it. It's an economic vehicle. Wealth in and of itself is not sinful. It's how it's obtained and what's done with it. And we find in the book of James an example of a business person who was wealthy because they mistreated their workers. And God said, they're going to cry out against you. And you're going to be judged. So God at times brings wealth to His people. And that's not sinful. But it's the pursuit of wealth. When you set that as the goal of your life. Talking to a young guy the other day that I've been kind of mentoring, a student at UNCG. And he made a comment. He actually asked me a question. It's been neat. He's been asking all kinds of spiritual questions. And he said, tell me about this passage in Matthew that talks about where you lay up your treasures. And his pastor had been talking about it. And I just went brain dead. There was a good point in there somewhere. I'll think about it in a minute. Well, it's left me, so I guess I need to leave that one alone. So, I know what it was. It came back. All right. So he said, Steve, he said, you know, I just want to like make $1 million a year or something like that. And I'm sitting back thinking, what have you been drinking or smoking or whatever? But that's what he's thinking. And so we had a good discussion around that type thing. So it's when we set that as the goal of our life and we let that drive us, it leads us into all kinds of evil, and Satan will use it as a tactic to derail godly people. And that brings us to the last one, Egypt, chapters 19 and 20. Now, we know who Egypt is. I don't think we need to go into a lot, but Egypt represents that power that held Israel captive. They were in bondage in Egypt. God delivered them from that bondage. And I think it's interesting. I never realized this. I think this is true. Never again did Egypt threaten to conquer Israel. Now, there was one time that I remember. I think it was Josiah or Joash, one of those two young kings. And he was doing all kinds of great things in Israel or in Judah. And one of the kings of Egypt was actually coming up to attack either the Syrians or the Assyrians. And he goes out to fight them. And the king of Egypt said, "Go back. I have no battle with you." Now, I think that's pretty significant. You know, he could and did squash him. He killed him. But that wasn't his intent. So spiritually, think of that. That which held us in bondage can never take us in bondage again. And that's what we see with Egypt. But what's happening here? Israel is being warned by God, don't lean on Egypt as your protector. And I think that has some spiritual significance for us. And as I thought about it, there are passages in Romans that it can parallel. But in Galatians chapter 5, I think it really kind of spells out for me the picture or the symbol that we have here. Galatians chapter 5 verse 1 says, "For freedom Christ has set us free. Stand firm therefore, and do not submit again to the yoke of slavery." Now he goes on to point out that rather than living in the power of the Spirit, the Galatians were wanting to go back to lean on the flesh, to lean on their works, to lean on what the law required as their method of living righteously. But we've been given the Spirit of God, which is our power for righteous living. And one of the tactics that Satan loves to use is to eliminate the dependence on the Spirit of God in the life of the believer. Just, you can do all your stuff. You can go to church. You can go through all the, you can do all kinds of service. But just, you know, just do it and think you're marking up little brownie points in heaven. And we don't depend on the Spirit of God to lead us and guide us. And I think that's another tactic that we see the enemy using. So, as we look at these, and there's much more to be gleaned from this passage, I would encourage you to read it and study it for yourself. I'm not going to go back through it. But I think this presents to us some good warnings and some good illustrations of how Satan tries to derail the believer. Now, what's the solution? I was going to spend a fair amount of time on this, but I don't have that time. So maybe it'll be for another message. But I want to make one point. The bottom line is that when Israel lived in obedience and closeness to God, the enemies were kept subdued. The enemies didn't have victory. But when Israel began to look to something other than God for their protection, for their provision, then the enemy would rear its head. In fact, there are a couple places where the Scripture says God left these nations there to test the faith of Israel. And I think we have the same thing. When we stay close to God, when we're in the Word on a daily basis, when we're drawing close to Him, not just reading it mechanically, but drawing close to Him and asking Him to teach us and to guide us, then the enemy stays away. Doesn't mean we won't have warfare. We will. But we have victory in that warfare. But when we get away from that, when we neglect that, then the enemy's going to get a foothold. And one of these tactics are going to come at us. And we need to be prepared, and we need to be armed, and we need to have our armor on. Thank you.